20 who ruled the roost in outpatients and sold the medicine for cigarettes and margarine, not to those who needed it, but to those who could afford it. Who was in charge of Block 9? Not the Block Eltester and the Block Arzt, but the quartermaster and his cronies, Polish ruffians in cohorts with the odd Russian. Medical work? Dr. Ochodzki, who was good to the bone, had nothing to do himself. There were about 10 admissions a day, and Ochodzki told them which ward to go to. That was 5 minutes' work. Otherwise, he spent the whole day on his bed. When the doorkeeper raised the alarm, he knew an SS man was approaching and quickly began examining someone. No, there wasn't any medical work, but there was enough work. Still, Block 9 had another inestimable advantage. After all, as sure as night follows day, 9 is always followed by 10. It was 4:30. "Get up! Gong!" the night watchman shouted as he turned on the light in the staff room. Almost all of them shot up. Yesterday, Paul, the Block Altester, had ranted and raved so much at a couple of men who were still in bed 5 minutes after the gong that nobody was brave enough to turn over again today. Only Gerhard stayed lying there for a moment. "Get up," Hans urged him. "Do you want to have to drag kettles around for an extra week?"
"Oh, Hans, I can't. I slept so badly. There's no straw left in my mattress, and I've been coughing so much."
"It's a bad cough, but not having any straw is your own fault. Yesterday there were 5 bales at Block 21. Gerhard really didn't have much get up and go when it came to things like that. He didn't stick up for himself. But what could you expect from a lad like that? A respectable middle-class family, son of a civil servant. They hadn't been wealthy, but they'd never had to struggle to get by either. How could someone like that stand up to all these Häftlinge? They were a nice bunch, the people you spent your days with. Black marketeers, pickpockets, and other antisocial elements. Any political Poles among them had been in the camp for years and were no longer exactly kind-hearted. They experienced that again after they'd hurriedly got up and were standing in the corridor half-dressed.
"What kept you, you bloody scum, you pathetic Hollanders?"
Kuchemba, the quartermaster, had a shove ready for both of them. That was your good morning. Then you had to trot off to the kitchen and pick out a big kettle of tea. If you came back with a small kettle, they'd curse you up and down or make you go back again. And if you came with a large kettle, half would end up getting thrown out. There was always more boiled ditch water available than the patients wanted. They raced in 4 pairs to the kitchen block, where 20 men from other blocks were already waiting. In the kitchen, more racket. The Unterscharführer had just caught a Russian organizing some potatoes. Not satisfied with beating the Russian bloody, he had immediately dealt with a couple of cooks and the doorkeeper, too. That was why they weren't allowed to wait inside, but had to stay outside until the tea had been poured into the kettles. It was cold. Snow was whirling through the courtyard, and their feet were already wet. Soon, they would be soaked to the skin. An undershirt and a linen coat didn't offer much protection. They pressed back against the plastered wall, sheltering from the worst of the snow under the eaves. But the Unterscharführer was coming their way again.
"What are you doing there, you filthy swine? Attention!"
Gerhard, who didn't line up fast enough, got a nice little kick on the ankle. A little kick, but how was he supposed to carry his kettle now, as if that bothered anyone? And so Van Damme, M.D., and the young psychologist von Weick stood there freezing on that wet, overcast November morning.
"Why do we have to wait so long?" Gerhard asked.
"You'd be better off asking why we had to leave the block so fast. You know what it's like by now. Bewegung, Bewegung, los, eile!"
They hurry you up on principle to make you waste as much energy as possible. After half an hour, the chilled men were finally let into the kitchen. The kettles were steaming hot. The warm, damp air penetrated their clothes, reviving them a little. The cooks were standing next to the kettles in grimy white uniforms, big poles, brash and brawny. You had to make sure not to go too close. They'd been working for hours under constant harassment and provocation. Now the capo was at it again.
Du Drecksau, you're spilling half of it. You want me to smash your face in for you?
The Pole shrugged. The capo was a German with a green triangle, the symbol for imprisoned criminals. He could have 5 murders on his conscience, but the SS had made him the supervisor and you just had to put up with it. Hans and Gerard had picked out a kettle and put the iron braces for carrying it underneath. Hans spotted a barrel of salt and remembered that Friedel had asked him if he could get her some. But as he was sticking a handful in his pocket, a stream of cold water hit him in the face. A cook who was rinsing out a kettle had caught him at it. Now he was sopping wet after all. But that, too, was something he would survive. He looked at the cook and grinned vacantly. How were you supposed to respond to being sprayed like that? Hit back? Madness. The cook was much stronger than him, well-fed, and, what's more, in the right. If you catch someone organizing, you're allowed to punish them on the spot. They picked up the kettle and trudged out of the kitchen. After just 25 yards, Gerard had to put it down again. He wasn't strong. A slight youth who'd never done any physical work, and the kettle weighed more than 200 pounds. Finally, they staggered into the block. By then, it must have been about 6 o'clock. Only the block L-tester had a watch, but you got a sense of time. In another hour, block 10 would open, and he still had a lot to do. Janus, the Stuben L-tester, had already started mopping the floor when Hans came in. It was a small ward with 28 patients, all Poles and Russians, Aryans. They slept in triple bunks. The ones in the top bunks got the most warmth. The bottom bunks had the most fleas, because although fleas are good at jumping, gravity makes them fall back down again. This was why the top bunks were occupied by the prominents, leading figures in Poland, many with titles and decorations, political prisoners who were held in high esteem by their fellow inmates. The lower bunks were occupied by simple folk, farmers and workers who had illegally slaughtered a pig, shouted out a swear word at a German soldier, or often not done anything at all they were aware of. Living among these people wasn't easy for Hans. The prominents were demanding, often refusing to submit to camp discipline, not wanting to get up at 4:30 to go and wash, wanting to keep food in their bed, and deeply insulted if you said anything about it when they threw onion peel and other rubbish down on the floor. The ordinary people in the middle and lower bunks made no effort at all to conceal their anti-Semitism. Hans was glad he couldn't understand what they said about him, but you felt something like that. He didn't let it get to him too much. What difference did it make? He looked out of the window just in time to see the prisoners lugging the tea kettles for block 10 up from block 19. Fortunately, Janus wasn't a bad chap and let Hans go. He ran outside. As long as the block L-tester didn't come now. No, the coast was clear. A Greek from block 19 was happy to let Hans take over from him. Hans was happy too. Panting nervously, he hauled the kettle up the steps and into block 10. There wasn't a single woman in the corridor. Yes, just one, a girl, really. She looked sideways at the men, but ran away when the doorkeeper appeared. They carried their kettle over to the staircase that led up to the first floor. The stairs were crowded with women jostling to collect tea. A fat Slovakian Stuben L-tester was blocking the stairs.
Nobody comes downstairs. Back! Back, you blöde Zauen!
She shoved the women and beat them back, and Hans started feeling faint at heart. How would he ever reach Friedel? But there was Betty. She saw him and raced upstairs. It took so long, and the doorkeeper was already shouting, Men out! Go on, go! He wouldn't get to see Friedel. Not this time. Yes, he would. She was coming. She worked her way through the throng on the stairs and came up against the Slovakian. Then Hans leapt over to her. My wife, let her, 1 minute. The Slovakian took her hand off the rail, and Friedel jumped down the last steps. He grabbed her hand. She went to kiss him, but he was too frightened. For a moment, they couldn't speak. She pulled herself together first. Hans, any news? No, Friedel, nothing. Do you get enough to eat? Yes, you can have some of my bread if you need it. A Pole gave me some from a package. No, sweetheart, you eat it. You work hard. I don't do a thing all day, waiting and waiting. Still, my luck's been holding out. Others, her voice caught. What? He insisted. She looked around nervously. They injected Lulu and Hans yesterday. For a second, he bit his lip. He understood why she was so nervous. They didn't know what exactly the injections were, but they were definitely awful. Friedel told him that Hans especially had had dreadful abdominal pain. She'd bled all night. The blood had come with cramps, 10 times as much as a normal period. And now she was lying on her bed, wretched and exhausted, and next week she'd have to go back to see the professor again. They were both silent, but in their eyes was the fear that one day she too would have to undergo the same thing. Then the doorkeeper came. During her confinement in the camp, she had forgotten how to talk and could only shout. That was what made her such a good doorkeeper.
Get out! Are you mad? All the men have left. If the Aufseherin comes, it'll be my head.
She screamed so loudly the Aufseherin was bound to come, and that was why it was better to go. Now Friedel could no longer control herself. She pressed herself against him and kissed him and kissed him, and he kissed her back. The doorkeeper was beside herself and threatened to get the Blockeltester. That was why Hans pushed Friedel away and forced himself to calm down.
Friedel, be brave.
I am brave, but it's so miserable for those girls.
I understand, but that won't last forever either.
How much longer?
I don't know, darling. It will turn out all right.
What else could he say? What else could he predict? Friedel was pure gold, but gold is a soft metal. And if she had been made of steel, it might not have been so easy for all this suffering to leave its traces on her. He walked away, fleeing, really, because he felt so powerless to comfort her. What help were words in the face of such deeds? Hans had a good inkling of what was going on in Block 10 and why. Wasn't mass sterilization one of the Germans' goals? Wouldn't they like to be able to sterilize all Jews, Poles, Russians, and possibly others? What could these gynecological experiments be if not attempts at sterilization? Jewish women were cheap guinea pigs. One could only delight in their suffering, and if they died a miserable death, it hardly mattered at all. In this dark mood, he returned to Block 9. He didn't receive a warm welcome. Paul was waiting for him in the corridor and began swearing furiously the moment he saw Hans coming in. He went through his entire repertoire.
Himmel, Arsch und Zwirn, Herrgott Sakrament, du verfluchter Idiot! Just walking off in work time. You've been in that whorehouse next door, haven't you? I don't understand how they can set up something like that in a respectable KZ. In Buchenwald, I literally didn't see a skirt for 5 years until they opened the brothel.
Jelena, the head doctor who was standing next to him, gave him a thump.
But then you were there every day, I suppose. What do you think? I didn't go there once. I might be a communist, one of those cursed red pigs, but you won't find me around whores. Anyway, they never got the better class of customer there in Buchenwald. Don't imagine for a minute you'd have seen a red triangle, a political prisoner, going into the brothel there. I don't understand what kind of spineless characters we have here in Auschwitz. They're queuing up there all evening. The food's too good here, Jelena mocked. But getting back to this emaciated streak of misery, Paul continued, returning to Hans, I'll laugh my head off if the Rapportführer bumps into you there one day. You know what they did to Florek, our barber, don't you? No. Florek was standing by the window conversing with one of those ladies from Block 10. You know what Florek's like, the requisite filthy chat, the requisite filthy gestures. And who should come along but Kaduk, the second Rapportführer? He grabs him by the back of the neck, makes a meatball of his face, and then marches him off to the Blockführerstube, where he reported him to Hössler, the Lagerführer. 25 on the backside. He got that helping right away, in the bunker with the pizzle. What's that? Just what I said, a dried bull's pizzle, a first-class Germanic disciplinary device. Florek had to lie on his stomach for 3 whole days. He still doesn't dare to sit down properly, and it's been 2 weeks already. Haven't you ever heard of the Land of 25? Jelena interrupted. That was German Southeast Africa. The standard punishment for the Negroes there was 25 of the best with a whip or a cane. So the whole country got it as a nickname. Paul said, We Germans just happen to be a savage nation. He glared at Hans with a terribly fierce expression, swore a little more, and then sent him off to Block 21. Because that was what the fuss was all about. There was a transport commando that day. There were already 15 men standing by Block 21. The doorkeeper gestured frantically, pushing the men into rows of 5 and madly cursing the blocks who still hadn't sent their contingent of laborers. It was all schnell, los, tempo. But after the 30 men had been drummed up, it still took another half hour for the SS guard to arrive. And when they'd finally marched out of the gate and arrived at the SS Krankenrevier, there were no wagons for them to use. The Rotenführer started negotiating, and they stood there waiting for another hour. It was cold, bitterly cold, and they were shivering in their linen suits in the middle of the street. The pavements, where prisoners swept away the snow, were reserved for the SS going in and out of the buildings. 3 large buildings, SS Revier, SS Standortverwaltung Südost, and the Kommandantur. These were real beehives, with men swarming in and out, along with the occasional young woman in smart clothes that had undoubtedly belonged to some now murdered young Jewish lady. Sometimes there were also Häftlinge from the Kommando SS Revier, who worked in the SS hospital as cleaners, with some prominence even working as chemists or dental technicians. They were well off. They ate SS food and had all the toiletries and medicine they needed. The Kommando SS Revier was the camp's most important source of medicine. The Häftlinge who worked there smuggled it into the camp, where they sold it in exchange for margarine, sausage, and clothes that others, in turn, had stolen from the Bekleidungskammer. All of the medicaments taken from the thousands who arrived on the trains ended up here in the large attics and the enormous hospital dispensary. Together with the consignments from the Sanitätslager der Waffen-SS in Berlin-Lichtenberg, they formed an enormous stock. From this central point, the medicine was distributed to the entire SS across the southeastern front. In the same way, the Auschwitz Bauhof was the distribution center for building materials for all those troops, and the whole of the Waffen-SS Südost was provided with war materials by Auschwitz factories. DAW, the Deutsche Ausrüstungswerkstätte, provided everything that was made of wood,
munitions chests in particular. The munitions themselves were made at the Auto Union and in the Buna factories. At Buna, they also made synthetic rubber. And here in these buildings was the headquarters of the enormous Auschwitz complex, which consisted of more than 30 camps. Auschwitz I, Hans's camp, Birkenau, the killing center, Monowitz with the Buna factories, and many smaller camps with mining and agricultural commandos. Altogether, more than 250,000 workers, all administered here in the Kommandantur and Standortverwaltung. No, Auschwitz was more than torment writ large. With its factories and mines, it was an important part of the Upper Silesian industrial area, and its workers were cheaper than anywhere else in the world. They didn't need any pay, and they ate almost nothing. And then, when they were exhausted and fell victim to the gas chamber, there were still enough Jews and political opponents in Europe to make up the numbers yet again. Berlin coordinated it all. In Wilhelmstrasse, there was a special concentration camp department under Himmler's command. There, they arranged the transports to the camps through all of Europe. They were the ones who sent the order to Westerbork, so many thousand to this or that camp. They calculated which percentage of the transport had to be exterminated immediately and how many people they needed as laborers. Yes, Grun, the dentist, who had been in the camp for 1.5 years, could explain exactly how it all worked. He was the model of a Pole who is not afraid of anything or anyone and never takes other people's interests into account. He was known all over the camp and always had the best jobs. His friends who worked in the political section had told him all kinds of secrets, command decisions, telegrams from Berlin. He had relationships with girls who worked at the SS Revier, and when he got caught, it didn't cost him his neck because he had another friend in the SS kitchen who slipped him a liter of gin for the SS man who had found out too much about him. But now Grun's position was a little tenuous after all. It was like this. Do you know what Faulgas is?
No.
Faulgas is a commando of 600 men. They live in blocks 1 and 2. They walk 3 miles every day to a site where they're building a big plant next to a marsh to extract energy from the rotting sludge. There are civilian workers there, too. Faulgas is the biggest commando for smuggling. The lads who work there take clothes and linen out with them, concealed under their uniforms, and sell them to the civilians for food, watches and jewelry, too. They get their merchandise from others who work in Canada. Everything from the trains goes there first. The people from Canada get a share of the takings. 2 months ago, I had a nice little deal going, but it went wrong. A fellow in Canada had found a couple of magnificent diamonds in the lining of a coat. He brought them to me because he knew I was in Faulgas. There was only one price for those diamonds: freedom. First, I paid work allocation a liter of schnapps, and that got my mate into Faulgas, too. Then we put out feelers with a Polish driver if he could mount a couple of boards under the bed of his truck for the two of us to lie on, between the crankshaft and the bed. But I had picked the wrong driver, because he was in with one of the guards. I happened to see the two of them talking and reported sick straight away. It cost me an arm and a leg, but the Kommandoführer ordered a guard to escort me back to camp. I wasn't even able to warn my friend. They beat him to death that same day. But they didn't find the diamonds on him because I'd already put them somewhere safe. You understand that since then I've been keeping a low profile, because now there are definitely a few SS men out for those diamonds. Hans understood something else, too. That when the deal went wrong, Grun sacrificed his friend and took off with the diamonds. If you want to shirk, Grun continued, the Krankenbau's the best. 0.5 liter of spirits and you're a Pfleger. Grun definitely knew how to shirk. The Rotenführer arrived. He had arranged a wagon.
They had to pick up bags from the train and unload them here. Grun had a quick word with him, and the Rotenführer gave him a pad and a pencil. He had to keep tally of the bags. They set out with the wagon. It was fairly calm. They were all Pfleger with a black badge embroidered with the letters HKB on their left sleeve, Häftlingskrankenbau. The Pfleger's letters were blue, technical staff had red, and the doctor's white. But that division was theoretical because here they were, all pushing the same wagon. As a symbol, the HKB worked miracles. With all their aversion to intellectualism, the SS were still scared of it. Was it coincidence that the intellectuals at Westerbork were able to hold their own the longest, and were then mostly sent to the privileged camp of Theresienstadt? Was it coincidence that doctors, who are intimately involved in questions of life and death, had the best chance of survival, not just in Auschwitz, but in other camps too? Definitely not. Primitive man lives in constant fear of the spirit world, and that world is made up of the souls of the dead. If you beat someone to death, their soul will be hostile toward you, and the greater their spirit or mind was in life, the more dangerous they will be as a malevolent spirit after death. Especially dangerous are doctors, the stewards of the spiritual legacy passed on from ancient wizards who had power over the spirit realm of the living and the dead. And who could be more primitive than the Übermensch? You had to be careful with doctors anyway. Even the greatest SS brute had an inner sense of you might need him one day. That was what they owed it to, the doctors and the nursing and technical staff, their not being hurried too much and hardly hit at all. But the work still had to be done, and it was a nasty job. It was a goods wagon full of paper bags. Malarial mosquito poison was printed on them, followed by the chemical formula, a sulfur compound. A lot of the bags were torn and leaking fine green powder. When you picked them up, the powder went down your neck and formed a crust in the close-cropped hair on your sweaty head. It got in your nose, which started to run, and in your eyes, which began to water. At first, you did your very best to keep the bag in the middle of your back and not spill any, but each bag weighed over 100 pounds, and once you were tired, you had to put the bag on your shoulder, and then it was liable to tilt. In no time, they were covered with powder, clothes and faces green. It was worst for your eyes, which stung and itched, and if you rubbed them with your dusty hands, they started to burn. You were blinded and couldn't go on, and had to put the bag down for a moment, but you couldn't do that either, as the work had to be completed within the allocated time, and that was the Rotenführer's responsibility, so he had to hurry you along. If you then complained about the wretched powder that hurt your eyes so much and stung your skin, the Rotenführer smiled enigmatically. He knew more than he was letting on. When they got back to their blocks in the evening, exhausted and with bloodshot eyes, they all felt awful. One was shivery, the other nauseous. They all had sore eyes, and some had come out in blisters. Hans felt ill. After roll call, he went straight to bed. The next day, he couldn't get up. He was running a temperature, and the skin on his shoulders, back, and everywhere the powder had reached was red and inflamed. He was not the only one. Four of the Pfleger had to stay in bed. Paul was quite reasonable. He sent others that day because the work had to go on. The new workers asked the Rotenführer if they could get something made of rubber to put over their backs and shoulders, or goggles to protect their eyes. But the Rotenführer just shrugged. What did a few sick Häftlinge here or there matter? One of the Pfleger had tried to bring a rubber sheet from a treatment room. The SDG, the SS orderly who inspected the hospital every day, bumped into him with it, gave him a few whacks, and seized the sheet.
Sabotage!
Sabotage if you tried to conserve your health, if you tried to protect yourself from poison. The milk they give workers in paint factories in Holland must be a mortal sin. Anyway, that evening a few more of us were sick. Paul looked concerned. The next day was the same. Now 7 of Block 9's 35 Pfleger were sick, just from the malaria powder. But the job was done. Hans was not dissatisfied. The fever would pass, his body would excrete the poison, and the patches of eczema that had formed everywhere would flake off. Meanwhile, the rest was doing him good. The only bad thing was not being in touch with Friedel. He had sent her a note saying he wasn't well, but she hadn't been able to get an answer back to him. The lads who took the food to Block 10 were too scared. A few had just been beaten, and one they'd found notes on had been sent to the Strafkommando in Birkenau. Then, on the fifth day, alarm. Paul came into the nurse's room. Los, everyone get dressed, eile! The Lagerarzt is in Block 19. He could be here any minute. They didn't know what was going on, but in the corridor Hans bumped into Grun. He looked very somber. It's been going well for too long. He hasn't been for 3 weeks. In that moment, the door opened. Achtung! Shouted the doorkeeper. Grun pulled Hans into the toilets with him. They heard the Lagerarzt going upstairs. Then a few of the sick Pfleger came into the toilets. Toni Hochstein, the Scheißmeister, was about to start swearing at them, but Grun gestured for him to keep quiet.
They've come here to hide, fathead.
Grun couldn't suppress his curiosity. He took Hans upstairs with him. They slipped into the ward and went to stand among the other Pfleger. Almost all of the beds were empty, and the men were lined up in the central corridor. The SDG wrote down the numbers of those who were severely ill and couldn't make it out of bed. When he was finished, the inspection began. It was disgusting, especially if you knew what it was about. The poor bags of bones, the worn-out, hollow-eyed skeletons, their bodies covered with wounds, standing stark naked in a long line, leaning on each other or holding on to beds. The Lagerarzt cast a quick glance at each of them, and the SDG wrote down the numbers of everyone he pointed out, about half of them. What's that for? One of the unfortunates dared to ask the Lagerarzt.
Halt's Maul!
But the SDG was a little more accommodating. The weak are going to a different camp. They have a special hospital there. The Pfleger within earshot sneered at each other. Special hospital, effective for all ailments. The Lagerarzt was finished and went downstairs. Hans felt a chill. Von Leer, the junior doctor, was in room 3 with the madmen. He had been too cocky. Not only had he taken to bed with his inconsequential foot wounds, he'd also moved to a bunk among the madmen in room 3 because 2 Dutchmen were working there, Van Wyk and Elie Pollock, and he liked the company. If only they'd hidden him. But after the Lagerarzt had left, Hans met Elie in the corridor. His face was stony.
Only 3 Reich Germans are allowed to stay. They wrote down all the other numbers.
Van Leer's too.
Van Leer's too, with the insane.
They went to see Paul, the block L-tester, to see if there was anything he could possibly do. Paul was a strange fellow. He wasn't bad. He never hit anyone. He yelled and threatened, but never took it any further. But he'd been in the camp too long to know any pity.
Van Leer? He was asking for it. He should have put in an effort. Why hasn't anything happened to either of you? You've worked here from the beginning, and that's why I put you with the Pfleger. But that waste of space.
Of course, that wasn't an argument. After all, the Lagerarzt had accepted Van Leer as a Pfleger too. If Paul had something against him, he could have chased him out of bed, or even, as Blok Eltester, he had the right, discharged him from hospital. He shouldn't have let him walk into a trap like that. But after years in concentration camps, even the best of people develop their own sense of justice. They develop their own tics. Ein Vogel, they call it. Van Leer stayed on the list and left with the others the next day. At 11 o'clock, the trucks arrived with a stream of SS men, the like of which Hans hadn't seen in the Krankenbau before. There was the Lagerführer with the two Rapportführer, the Lagerarzt with the SDG, the truck drivers, and many others. They gesticulated wildly and were especially rough and currish. No, this definitely didn't look like a transport to a special hospital, as the SDG had put it. The Blok Eltester was given a list with the names and numbers of the victims. They had to line up as quickly as possible, were given trousers and sandals, and were then rushed onto the trucks. The most seriously ill, who couldn't walk, were carried down on stretchers by the Pfleger. If they didn't go fast enough, the Pfleger got a kick, and the SS took charge of the unfortunate patient, who was thrown into the back of the truck like a sack of flour. These people weren't heavy. A man who was by nature a sturdy, solid fellow of, say, 175 pounds, would now only weigh 110 or 115. And the wretches with a normal build weighed 85 at the most. It's a law of nutrition that even when wasting away, the heart, brain, and organs maintain their normal weight the longest. As a result, most of them were all too aware of what was happening to them. They still had such a strong will to live. Many of them were crying and complaining to the Pfleger. A 16-year-old youth kicked up an enormous fuss. Then an SS man came and hit him with his belt. The boy screamed even louder. The SS man hit him harder still. German pedagogy was not, however, helpful. Have you ever seen a drunk man kicking a howling dog? The dog starts howling even louder. And though the man is drunk, he feels that the howling is justified and an indictment of his brutality. The man is not capable of a conscious sense of remorse, but the dog's complaints still arouse uncomfortable feelings in him, which he masks by increasingly brutal behavior. Harder kicks, louder howls, until in the end the man kicks the dog to death. Finally, it is no longer able to denounce him. In the same way, the SS man hit harder and harder, and the boy screamed louder and louder. In the end, he picked him up and threw him into the back of the truck like a ball. Then the boy was quiet. Hans stood in the downstairs corridor at the door to room one and thought about it. No, you could never educate these people to genuine remorse, even if they were one day called to account. A just punishment would only engender greater hatred in them. And even if they pretended to be reformed, they would only conspire again as soon as they were set loose on humanity. For them, in the future, there could only be one possible punishment, death. That would be the only way to protect a new society. Hans dug his nails into his flesh to restrain himself. Resistance, even a show of pity, would have been pointless suicide. During one of the previous selections, a Pfleger went to help one of the poor wretches. The SS supervisor did not approve of the whole process being delayed for a single bandage. The Pfleger objected. The Lagerarzt came up, wrote down the Pfleger's number, and had him put on the truck with the others. Then Van Leer came down the corridor. Slowly he approached Hans. Wearing a filthy undershirt and clacking sandals, with his head bowed over his tall, skinny body and swinging his long arms, he was the image of misery. It was as if Death, who he was about to meet, had already taken up residence inside of him. He wanted to speak to Hans. But Hans was at his wit's end, and his courage failed him. He knew what Van Leer was going to ask, but he didn't know how to answer. That was why he turned away. It was a flight, a cowardly flight. He slunk off behind the big brick stove, but couldn't suppress his tormented curiosity, and finally went back to the window. They were ready now. The tailboards had been slammed shut. SS guards had climbed up onto the backs of the trucks, and the transport was about to drive off to Birkenau. Hans gripped the windowsill. He heard the Poles in their beds in loud discussion. He wanted to cry out, motivated by a vague feeling that someone would hear his cry and rush to help. But no sound made it past his lips. Silent tears welled up in his eyes. Then an arm wrapped around him. It was Zimmer, the fat Pole from Posen.
"Yes, son, they won't be complaining anymore. Their song of woe is over."
Hans shuddered. The man felt it.
"Come on, you have to be braver. You're in a very different position. You're fairly well off here in the room with us. You're young and strong, and you know the head doctor likes you."
"You're right, Zimmer, but it's not for me. It's for those people going to slaughter so meekly."
Zimmer smiled for a moment. "Thousands have gone that way already.
Millions. Did you cry then? It's only now it's right in front of your nose that you're so upset.
But I don't blame you. You've seen so little. When the Germans invaded our country in 1939, they marched straight into the Jews' houses. The men were driven into groups to be transported to labor camps. The women were raped,
Rassenschande, a violation of their own race laws, but that didn't bother them.
I saw them take little children by the feet and smash their heads against trees or doorposts. That was in fashion at the time. Every year there seems to be a new fashion in the SS. In 1940, it was the fashion to literally tear children apart. In 41, they'd take a tub of water and push the children's faces into it. They'd drown the poor little devils in 4 inches of water. Lately, they've calmed down a little. Now they kill the Jews with gas. The camps are sanatoriums compared to a couple of years ago, because they are killing people much more systematically now. A lot must have happened in your region.
Don't talk to me about it, son. We Poles, we know the Germans. Over and over again they've hacked away at us, always dividing our country and annexing the best parts of it.
Posen, Poznań in Polish, Danzig, that we know as Gdańsk, and Stettin. They've gobbled up the most beautiful parts of Poland again now.
But it doesn't matter where they set their borders. If they win the war, they'll enslave all of Poland. But they'll lose, and when they do, justice will be ours.
That was how he distracted Hans from the awful events that had taken place that morning. Meanwhile, there was a Kesselkommando. The task of delivering soup to Block 10 fell to the 5 hospital blocks on a weekly roster. This week it was Block 9's turn, and Hans was carrying a kettle together with Meisel, the quiet, gentle Belgian doctor whose wife was also in Block 10. Most of the Pfleger were keen to get into Block 10. A lot of them had a girlfriend there. But even those who didn't know anyone wanted to spend a few seconds in the presence of women. That was why it was a crazy race from the kitchen to Block 10, because the 4 pairs who arrived first with their soup were allowed to deliver it there. The others had to take it to the men in Block 9. On top of that, Hans and Meisel always picked out a heavy kettle. They felt that what a lot of the men did was a betrayal, wanting to see the women. They chose a small kettle to make it easier to get there first. In the process,
disadvantaging those same women by taking them too little soup. But none of that mattered, because with a different goal in mind than just a girlfriend, they were capable of a greater effort. And when Maisel, who was 10 years older than Hans, couldn't keep up, they arranged the kettle on the poles so that Hans, who was strong and had tremendous endurance, was carrying most of the weight. That way, they were generally first to arrive with their kettle. Friedel was already waiting in the corridor. The doorkeeper, the she-devil, had grown used to them and was a little less hostile. Friedel smiled and put her hand on his chest. "Silly boy, exerting yourself like that. Your heart's racing. That can't be good for you. Be glad it's still beating." And immediately he felt the sharp pain of what he had seen that morning. He tried to conceal it, but she had already noticed. The women had seen all kinds of things from their windows, too. "How is it with the husbands of the girls here?"
"Miel Buchbinder is all right, Heini and Gunther, too. But a fellow called Geitenmann is gone from Block 19.
"My God, what am I going to tell her? She was pacing back and forth all morning, completely beside herself. She was already so scared, because he's been in such a poor state. But she refuses to face up to it. I've even got a packet of bread here that she's given me for him."
Hans thought it best to pretend everything was all right. Then in a few days they could tell her he was suddenly gone, transferred to another camp. No matter what, they mustn't let her know he'd been taken with today's selection.
"The poor girl. Samuel was at her this week, too. She's been in a lot of pain and bled terribly. Can you get your hands on some cotton wool or cellulose? I can't possibly get enough here if they take as many samples as last week."
Betty, Miel's wife, came up. She had two packets with her, one for Miel and one for Heini Spittel from his wife. "There aren't any letters in there, are there?" Hans asked. "Getting caught with a packet of bread wasn't too bad, especially if you could show that it was from a woman for her own husband. But letters were different."
"There's a letter in my packet."
"Get it out of there quickly, then. I'd rather hide it under my clothes." Hans was starting to get nervous, because the doorkeeper had chased away almost all of the other men. He would have liked to discuss a few more things with Friedel, but arranging the packets always took a lot of time. Friedel could tell he was getting impatient.
"Just leave them. You're still their only chance of keeping in touch with their husbands."
But before he could answer, the doorkeeper had spotted him, even though he'd hidden a little among the women.
"Have you gone mad?" she said, launching into her usual torrent of abuse.
He wanted to spare himself the rest and gave Friedel a hasty kiss. But Friedel wouldn't accept that. She grabbed hold of him to at least say a proper goodbye. Suddenly a door opened somewhere. A big fat woman appeared, one who looked like she'd come straight from a fish market, but without the clear, healthy complexion of a Dutch fisherwoman. Filthy, wispy, tow-colored hair, a round, pasty face that formed a vile contrast to her scarlet-painted lips. She was heavily pregnant and looked grotesque in her poorly fitting uniform.
"Was ist hier los, ihr Dreckhuren?"
It was a farce. This Nazi slut cursing his Friedel and the other women, who had given him bread they themselves had gone without to take to their husbands, as dirty whores. But the stick she was holding so casually was less farcical. That was why Hans kept himself hidden behind the women and slipped past the Aufseherin with the packets under his coat. He didn't breathe again until he was back in Block 9. That could have gone badly wrong. In Block 9, the soup kettles had already been distributed to the various rooms and wards. In the small rooms downstairs, small meaning 50 patients per room, the sick men were allowed to stay in bed, and the Pfleger took the soup around. Janus, the Stubenältester, stood by the kettle to dish out the soup, 1 liter per person. Hans took the red tin bowls around. There were various patients who didn't want the soup. They ate too much from their packages. That meant soup to spare,
and Hans was able to fill another bowl with 2 liters and take it upstairs to give one of his fellow Dutchmen a little extra. Upstairs, it was organized differently. There, the patients queued up in long lines with a bowl in their hands to receive their scoop from the kettle. Only the severely ill were allowed to stay in bed. The room orderlies brought them their food. Their lordships, the Pfleger, were too lazy to keep the ward clean and take food to the patients. Instead, they had delegated the work to a few patients who were not quite so ill. Everyone was happy to be chosen for a job like that, because it got you an extra liter of soup a day and meant you wouldn't be discharged from hospital and put in an outside commando. It was dangerous, of course. If the Lagerarzt came to pick out Musselmen, the room orderlies had to hide in the attic or latrines. When Hans entered the ward with his bowl of soup, people yelled out to him from all sides, "Pfleger, give me some soup!" They pulled out the margarine they'd saved up and their bread from the previous day to buy the soup from Hans. There were plenty of Pfleger who played along with things like that. The camp had a fully functioning black market. There were even fairly fixed prices. A liter of soup went for half a ration of bread or a whole ration of margarine. Some Pfleger and room orderlies exchanged 5 or more liters of soup for better quality food every day. There were even doctors who smuggled bowls of soup out of the window for some extra margarine. If caught, they would be kicked out of the Krankenbau, but they didn't let themselves get caught. Hans stayed aloof from all this buying and selling. It wasn't that he was so very virtuous. He didn't need it as badly. Back downstairs, Zimmer called him to one side and pressed a packet in his hand. "This week's package arrived today." Hans had to disappear quickly with his packet. The other Poles weren't allowed to see it. They would ridicule Zimmer for his kindness. He opened it in a corner of the nurse's room. It contained 2 apples, a piece of cake, and a piece of bacon. He ate one of the apples and a bit of the cake immediately, hiding the rest under his mattress for Friedel. Then back to work, washing up bowls, sweeping the room. Kuchemba, the quartermaster, called. There was bread that had to be fetched, and he needed a couple of sturdy lads. 120 loaves of bread, that was 375 pounds in a carrying frame. Then another kettle commando, evening tea. On top of it all, a ticking off from Paul.
"Du Dreckhund, haven't you seen that tea's been spilt on the outside steps?"
The outside steps were one of Hans's responsibilities.
"A job like that's an honor. The steps are our block's visiting card. You have to do your best to honor our block. Go and clean them up, fast. Give them a good scrub. Throw a couple of buckets of water over them, then with the broom. Yes, you know how."
Hans certainly did. He ran through the corridors with the buckets of water like a man possessed, and made as much fuss as possible to show everyone how hard he was working. That way he avoided one of his bosses reserving him for a subsequent job, and was able, once he'd mopped the excess water off the steps, to slip into Ward 3 for a moment. Ward 3 was the psychiatric department, where Eli Polak was the doctor. Eli was sitting in his corner at a table and staring drowsily into space. He was always a bit down and never seemed to have much energy. Although he was only 35 and physically robust, he often gave the impression of being a worn-out old man who wasn't up to anything anymore. It was understandable. Just 3 weeks after coming to Auschwitz, he had heard that his wife and child, like all women with small children, had gone to Birkenau and up the chimney immediately after arriving from Holland. "You know," he began telling Hans, "I was standing in my line. My wife was loaded onto the truck, and I believe she fainted right then. I think somehow she'd caught on to what was going to happen."
"Don't talk rubbish," Hans snapped.
He felt powerless to comfort Ailey, and in situations like this, people often hide their embarrassment behind coarseness.
"What could she have noticed? And you know very well that they would have gone to the crematorium no matter what, whether she fainted or not."
Then Walter started.
In the name of the Führer, I, Walter, have been chosen as the Thousand-Year Reich's eternal delegate to the moon. I am the ruler over all stars and planets. My sister gave me 3 Reichsmarks, and that enabled me to maintain my economic control over the Hermann Göring works. With our new weapons, I have succeeded in tightening my hold on the universe. And in the name of the Trinity, Hitler, Goebbels, and Göring, I am the Viceroy of the Great Regions. My power knows no bounds. The Führer commands. The crazies in the ward will now hold a free election. Vote! 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 You first, you dead loss, you sleepyhead. Vote for the salvation of our pan-Germanic empire. You damned Democrat, will you wake up for once?
He gave the poor imbecile who shared a bed with him a good shaking and hit him hard on the head. The man sat up and muttered something incomprehensible.
Millions, millions are marching under our banners. Our blood has impregnated the eternal goddess of truth, and she has given birth to the Führer, who will show us the way to the greatest realm of perfection. My children are the worms of blood and soil. Their castings fertilize the earth that brings forth the corn with which we will withstand the blockade of England. You dirty, disbelieving dog, get up! March in our ranks! Judenblut spritz vom Messer! Everything is in our favor! March!
And again he hit and kicked the poor, bald-headed fool, who in his fear raised his hands to Walter in supplication. Ailey had gone over and was trying to calm Walter down. That's right, Walter. The procession is tomorrow. You have to go to sleep today.
I shall never sleep, Doctor. I am Siegfried, watching over the eternal maiden Brunhilde. She is slumbering in the tavern with the dragon, the Führer's father. I am the bodyguard of the brown blood. I am the banner of triumph. Hurrah! Hurrah! I am Germania's son! Our columns are marching! March! March!
He had leapt out of bed and was now marching back and forth across the room while roaring in ecstasy. All the madmen were in an uproar under Walter's rabble-rousing influence. Sitting on the sides of their beds, they were swinging their arms and legs. Pathetic idiots, otherwise completely calm, were slurring out inarticulate songs. A blissfully smiling hydrocephalic beat time on his bowl, while his cataract-covered eyes bulged in his horrifically swollen head. Walter carried on marching, with Ailey in hot pursuit.
"I am the boss! I am the apostle! I am the Führer of the whole madhouse!"
"That's right," Hans said. Then the roar of swearing drowned out the tumult.
"Herrgott Sakrament verflucht nochmal! What's going on here?"
It was Paul, who had been alerted by the hullabaloo and had come to investigate. It was soon over. He grabbed Walter by the scruff of the neck and sat him down on his bed. The whole meeting started to ebb away.
"Give him an injection, Pollock. What are you standing there for, you good-for-nothings?"
Ailey gave Walter his injection, and things gradually calmed down. Paul pulled a chair up to the table.
"Listen, lads, you can't let things get out of hand so quickly. I've been in this madhouse for 10 years now. You think I'm going to let myself be bullied around by a nutcase who thinks he's the Führer? The Führer himself hasn't cut me down to size yet."
"Achtung!"
ran through the building. Paul ran out of the room. Ailey started cleaning his needle, and Hans grabbed a broom and began sweeping diligently.
"Bewegung!"
It was the SDG on his daily round. At first he'd ranted and raved, but recently he'd been mild. Jelena, the head doctor, had discovered his weak spot. Now, when the SDG went into the Blockältester's room, there was always a packet of cigarettes waiting for him. The Poles were happy to take turns offering one up out of their packages to avoid troublesome inspections. They could keep clothes in their beds, cook in the big stove now and then, and commit lots of other small transgressions. It wouldn't last much longer. The SDG would soon be transferred, and a new one would come in his place. The camp leadership knew all too well that every guard, no matter how fierce, eventually comes to some level of accommodation with his prisoners. That's why the SDGs and all those who had a lot of contact with the Häftlinge were regularly transferred. 3 weeks later, the new SDG showed up. He was a tall man with a blonde mustache. He came to look around a little the first day and seemed very moderate. But a few days later, he ordered all of the patients in the Polish ward out of bed. What was going on? If it had been the Jews, they would have thought it was a selection, because they came there more or less every week to pick out the unfortunates. But the Poles? Hans and the Stubenältester had to empty all of the beds and open all of the packages. All kinds of things appeared: clothes, shoes, old rags, moldy bread, and hundreds of other things. Everything was thrown on a pile. They were allowed to keep most of the food from the packages, but the SDG pocketed the tobacco and any special items like sardines or chocolate. Meanwhile, he carried out random checks, searching the patients and looking under the mattresses to make sure everything had been removed. Those who were wearing more than a single undershirt had to throw it on the pile and got a few slaps in return. Zimmer scowled. He had received a magnificent woolen jumper and a pair of boots in the false bottom of a package. Now he was going to lose it all. It was already winter. One of these days he might be sent out in a commando. The clothes and all the other gear were packed in blankets, and the SDG said that it all had to go to the Blockältester's room. He had just started to count the bundles when a shot sounded outside in the street. The SDG walked over to the other side of the room to look out of the window, and Hans seized his opportunity. With a bundle under each arm, he slipped into the corridor. When he came back, the SDG was standing over the bundles. Hans beat him to it. "I've already taken one away." "Good, five more." Hans walked back and forth five more times, and the SDG paid careful attention that nothing disappeared out of the bundles. When everything was in the Blockältester's room, he locked the door and took the key with him. He would come back later to pick it all up. But Zimmer's jumper and boots and the other choice items were already in the attic. That evening, Hans was rich. Zimmer had given him half a pound of bacon when he'd returned his things. Just like that, in public. And the others whose possessions Hans had rescued didn't dare hold back either. Bacon, sugar, apples, white bread, and more. He was beaming as he stood near the Block 10 window to tell Friedel about his adventures. "I'll bring you some of it tomorrow. Keep enough for yourself." "I will." But he knew he would give most of it to her, because when he saw her at the window, he heard her coughing, and she had already asked for cough medicine once before. He had asked her to take her temperature, and she'd done it now for a couple of evenings, 99.1 degrees Fahrenheit and 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit under the arm. "It's nothing," she said. But Hans was scared. He'd already spotted a new enemy, TB. He would fight against it. He would look after her. Sending food was all he could do, but he would do it as long as he could. When he was lying in bed and thinking of how he had outsmarted the SDG, he felt a sense of satisfaction. A calmness he hadn't known for a long time came over him, and he fell asleep with a smile on his face. One morning, Hans was called in to see the Blockältester. "Van Damme, you have to go to quarantine." He was shocked and thought he was being kicked out of the Krankenbau again. But Jelina, who was also present, laughed and reassured him. "They've got scarlet fever in quarantine and they need a doctor. For the time being, patients aren't allowed to be admitted from there to the Krankenbau.
They're not allowed to go to the main outpatients to get their wounds dressed in the evenings either. That's why we have to send a doctor there to do the work on the spot. An hour later, Hans arrived in quarantine. He was taken to the Blockältester, who met him with an ironic smile. So this is the doctor, is it? That means you're the boss here now. Well, it will all be fine then. He led Hans to one of the rooms. In the corner, a small cubicle was curtained off with blankets. Behind them was an ordinary triple bunk. The Stubenältester slept on the ground floor with the clerk above him. The top bunk was for Hans. The Stubenältester gave him a few tips.